Thank you for downloading the Saturday Live podcast. For more details about our terms of use, please go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio4. Do enjoy the show. Thank you very much and a very warm welcome to Saturday Live. Quick, before it melts.
He thought I looked like a monkey.
I find it embarrassing.
Darling fat nose.
If there's answers out there.
I keep on telling him how interesting I am.
Very foolish. Drawings on the walls.
Neuroses.
Yeah.
Neuroses.
Where's my sticks?
Sticks.
Monkeys. Parties. Egos.
On the programme this morning, we meet a young man who sleepwalks, and when he does, he draws. Our I Was There feature is set in Zimbabwe, formerly known as Rhodesia, and features offstage parts for some disco lights and Prince Charles. Carly Simon does her inheritance tracks, and we journey into space with Robert Harrison, who built his own space station with remarkable results. It's all after a poem from Elvis.
This is a wee suggestion of the best thing you can do on this slightly dreich bank holiday weekend. Hoary-headed frosts entomb a host of golden daffodils. Bleak blizzards bewail their icy lament. Now is acrimonious winter, made spring of discontent. A time to stay interred in the sepulchre of sleep, as April showers extinguish the sun, to be buried deep down in the duvet with Radio 4, cup of tea and one more hot cross bun.
Thank you very much. Lee Child was born in Coventry, and although he loved drama and art at school, he headed to university to read law. On leaving, he took what he thought was a temporary job at Granada Television, but ended up staying for 20 years. And neither of those disciplines are why he's here now. His life story could form the spine of a good book, because having been made redundant from that successful career in television, he set off for the stationers, bought himself a notebook, and started writing. The result was a first-time best-selling book, a rarity in the world of crime fiction. It was called Killing Floor, and the hero that Lee created was called Jack Reacher, and the rest is publishing history. He now sells somewhere in the region of 1 million books a year. 61 Hours is the latest Reacher thriller set against the freezing storms of a South Dakotan winter. Lee tends to write in the afternoon. He has an appalling diet and refuses to exercise. He's the third notable Saturday Live guest to enjoy driving a Jaguar, a small chocolate prize for knowing the other two, and his books have an American tone. He once said that's because America is where the best audience lies, not just in numbers but in sophistication and literacy. Should we be offended over here, Lee?
Well, I don't think you should be offended, but it's true. America is more literate than you think, and also people are more willing to take a chance. They're adventurous about what they're going to read. I think in Britain there's a little bit of stick in the mud. People will stay with what they've known before. In America, people will take a chance because they talk to each other. You know, a bookseller can say to a customer, no, no, try this instead. And the customer will lay out their $25 on that recommendation. I think British people are a little inhibited when it comes to that kind of thing.
We gave you a mention on the programme last week because Anthony Horowitz thought that you were the natural progression for boys and girls who'd read all of the Alex Rider books. What did you read as a boy? Were you a voracious reader?
Totally voracious, all the time, partly because I'm very old now. And, of course, back then, which some of your viewers, some of your listeners won't remember, is that there wasn't much else to do. So we read all the time. Enid Blyton. I read very ordinary things. Enid Blyton, Captain W.E. Johns, Alastair MacLean, same as everybody else did.
Jack Reacher has no tedious self-pity. He's an interesting crime fiction hero in that regard, isn't he? Is that something that you share with him? I mean, when you were made redundant, you turned it into a very positive thing, although I'm sure it really stung at the time. But did that form in you this kind of nugget of appreciation for not kind of looking back or feeling sorry for yourself?
Yeah, I felt very sorry for myself for about a second and a half, and then I realised, look, you just got to get on with it and do something else. I felt more upset with the way that a cultural institution was vandalised. I felt upset on other people's behalf. As far as I was concerned, I thought, yeah, well, let's just get on with it. Let's do something else. And I must admit the fury and the kind of anger definitely spurred me on. I think it was that extra little bit of motivation and that extra little bit of energy that you need in a situation like that. Mm. So I never felt sorry about it, but I did feel very obstinate, very determined, a kind of I'll show you type of thing.
You've embraced an American life, haven't you? Your wife is American, mm-hmm. apart from anything else, and obviously you really enjoy living over there now. But do you have to be careful that you don't kind of lose yourself to America? Because would that take away something from the ability to observe and then write about it?
Definitely it would. And also the character of Jack Reacher is, although he's American, he's American military, which means that he served all around the world and never really lived domestically in America. So he has an outsider's eye the same way that I do. And you're right that if I ever got so familiar with it that I lost that outsider status, then it would be a problem. I'd just be an American like everybody else. And as far as that goes, I've not become a citizen. I'm still a British citizen, and I kind of like that, to not be a citizen of where I'm living. Mm-hmm. If I came back to live here, I'd probably have to become a citizen of somewhere else in order to still be an outsider.
You say that you had two muses at the beginning, and they were fear and hunger. Uh-huh. When you get to the stage where I think your latest advance, Lee, is rumoured to have been an 8-figure sum, which is quite a lot of money.
Yeah.
What do you do? Where do you find that inspiration if where it came from at the beginning was this desire to succeed?
Well, now what it is, you're right. I mean, the money has become too much to really think about, because all I wanted to do was replace my salary and pay the bills. And as soon as I pass that point, the rest of it becomes fairly meaningless. So now I feel I still have a contract, but it's a kind of emotional contract with the reader. They did me the enormous compliment of buying and liking the early books, which set this whole thing going. And so they deserve the best I can give them each time that I write a book. I try and write it like it's both my first and my last ever book, so that it's as well as I can do. And to do any less than that, I think, would be shortchanging the reader. And that's the motivation for me now, is to just keep them happy.
If I emailed your website, would you email me back? Do you like to have that close a relationship with your readers?
I used to answer every email, but as emails became, as the internet became a bigger thing and as more books sold, it just became impossible. I would do nothing else other than answer emails. But probably if your name was on it, I probably would answer it. Yeah.
Oh, that's kind. Were you somewhere very cold when you wrote 61 Hours? Because, you know, aside from being drawn into the plot, you are very drawn into this freezing cold South Dakotan winter.
I wanted it to be a cold book because I did one before called Echo Burning, which was a very hot book, set in the west of Texas in a heat wave in the summer. And I thought, could I do the same thing with cold? And it worked well for me, actually, because I write during the winter, and the winter in New York is very cold. And so I was writing with the weather rather than typically writing against the weather, because actually most of the other books have been quite warm weather books. Which is fine in September when I start out writing them, but by the time I get to January and February, when I'm right there in the climax of the book, I'm writing against the weather. I'm writing about some hot place, people wearing T-shirts, and I'm actually freezing. Mm. So this book went with the flow, and I was happy with the way the weather came out. The weather is almost a character in the book. It's certainly a limit on what the characters can do.
How appalling is your diet?
Well, on my tour blog this year, I noted very happily that I'd managed to eat 3 hamburgers in the same day. That was my diet for that day. Okay. And it's pretty bad, yeah.
We have a legendary fruit platter here in the studio, which I think is now photographed and up on Facebook. You've not moved closer to it,
no,
I notice.
No, I think I'm going to try and sneak away from it towards Elvis, actually.
Yes, many people do. It's lovely to have you here, Lee, and you're happy to take questions. 84844 is our text number this morning. Lee will be here until 10. Now, for the last 30 years or so, Lee Hadwin has rarely had a good night's sleep. He suffers from somnambulism. He's a sleepwalker, and since the age of 4, he regularly gets up in the middle of the night and wanders around. But whilst he is wandering, he also does something extraordinary. He draws pictures, and not just random sketches, but intricate, detailed, and sometimes quite beautiful drawings. Some are abstract, some are portraits, and the really odd thing is that when Lee is awake, he says he can't draw for toffee. His case is a rare one, and his interest doctors and psychologists around the world, and he popped in to see us a few weeks ago. We started by talking about when his sleepwalking first began.
I was around about 4 years old. My mum told me the next morning that I'd been running around the bedroom like I was foraging for wood, because I kept saying, where's my sticks, where's my sticks? That was basically every few weeks, and it was like I was trying to build something.
A four-year-old sleepwalking is not an uncommon occurrence, is it? So was your mother, you know, unduly concerned about it?
Well, my mum was a sleepwalker herself. Even to this day, she sleepwalks, so she put it down to something that runs in the family. And obviously, kids of that age do sleepwalk anyway, so, yeah, it was never looked at anything unusual.
And, in fact, your mother's sleepwalking was very unusual, wasn't it? I mean, she nearly hurt herself.
She nearly jumped out the bedroom window. If it wasn't for my dad of stopping her, she would have jumped, so I think you can do yourself harm.
Yeah, that is quite dangerous, isn't it, by anybody's standards. After it had started, were there any periods when it stopped, or did you just carry on sleepwalking?
No, from that age, I carried on sleepwalking right up until I was about 18, 19 years old, right through my teens and my early years.
And how often were you sleepwalking?
It varied. Sometimes I could sleepwalk three or four times a week, and then I wouldn't sleepwalk for 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah, there was no pattern, really.
When did the drawing start?
Late 4, going on to 5 years old. I started going downstairs and going under the stairs, and we'd just scribble on the walls under the stairs. And that was like anything from pencils or what I could get my hands on. And then that progressed then into my bedroom, on bedroom walls, etc.
Your poor mum.
Yeah, very distressing for my parents in that sense.
Yes, yeah.
With the walls.
Were you drawing anything in particular?
At that time, no, it's just like any child would do. So you'd look at it and think it's just scribbling. And that's what it was right through my early teens. It was only up until I was 15 years old where my drawings started getting intricate.
And they are extremely intricate, aren't they? I mean, let's fast forward a tiny bit, because we've got one of your most recent nighttime activity drawings in front of us here. You describe for me what that is.
Well, basically, it's a pencil drawing. And to me, it's like hundreds and hundreds of little crosses or squares. That was around about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And, yeah, I've got up in the middle of the night and just started drawing that.
Mm. I mean, it's quite beautiful. It looks like a mosaic, shattered mosaic. This one is extraordinary. This is actually a portrait, isn't it? When did you do that?
Yeah, I did that when I was around about 16, 17 years old. Now, there's a bit of debate about this one. I think it's personally Kim Wilde, because I was a big fan of Kim Wilde growing up, but a lot of people say it's Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can see both of those women in there. You say that you actually can't draw when you're not in the sleepwalking state.
Yeah, in my waking life, so to speak, I've never been able to draw, because a lot of people, yeah, find it incredible that I can do this whilst I'm asleep, and yet I can't draw in my waking life, and I've tried.
When you first started to do these drawings, though, you know, as a teenage boy, I mean, it must have been quite disturbing to find out that you were doing something in a trance-like state that you couldn't do as a waking boy.
On a personal level, it wasn't, because even to this day, I have no connection to the drawings. The only disturbing thing that I think my parents were more disturbed at was the drawings on the walls, because obviously decoration-wise, and I remember cutting up a pair of my jeans and drawing on them. That was the only disturbing
part. But that's a slightly dangerous activity for a young boy to be doing.
Well, it is, and what you do, you can't lock your child up in a bedroom, you know, so...
And did they just get very used to it? I mean, they didn't ever try and wake you up? Or
totally. I mean, even going
area?
To the doctors at a young age, the doctor just said, you'll either grow out of it or it's just part of his sleeping.
And did anybody ever take it too seriously? Did anybody ever say, you know, this must be a child who's traumatised during the day and it's coming out somewhere at night?
Not really. It's only now where, when I've spoken to psychologists and that, they think it's from my earlier years growing up and losing some friends, etc., that, I don't know, the anxiety in me has come out more, but then you go back to a four-year-old, I didn't really have much anxiety as a four-year-old.
So you don't actually attach any particular credibility to those theories?
No, not at all.
Does it worry you?
Only the migraines. What happens to me normally if the night after I've done the drawings, the morning I wake up, that's when the migraine comes on, round about 15 minutes once I've woken up. I can feel that coming on. I mean, I'm vomiting, and that's how bad they are. It's been strange, the latest drawings over the last 2 years, because I've been doing a lot of circles, etc. I've had a lot of interest from some people who are into physics from New Zealand, and they've been looking at my drawings in depth and saying that there's something there, but they won't go into too much depth, so I've got to wait to hear from them. So.
Do you think it's something disturbing and dark?
Not really. I don't look at my drawings and think, oh, that's a dark drawing. I never have done. I don't feel like I'm a dark person, so I'm quite a positive person, I think.
What happens if someone tries to wake you up whilst you're doing one of these drawings?
I still go back into a trance state and I just go to bed as if nothing's happened. I get up the next day. What's strange, whether they've tried to wake me up or the next morning, I know I've done something, even though I don't remember doing it. It's like I've got 1,000 thoughts going through my brain at once. I can't explain it.
Does the level of curiosity and interest that people have become slightly annoying sometimes?
I find it embarrassing. You're going out with friends and then people come up to you and start talking. They automatically think, I draw in my sleep and that's it. But then when they find out you can't draw whilst you're awake, that's when you start getting the interest. Yeah, some of the video footage and that I find quite embarrassing.
Yes, now the video footage.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, who's been making the videos of you? I mean, they're all with your consent, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, obviously my partner and close friends. Some of them, I've got my clothes on, some I'm completely nude. So, yeah, it is a bit embarrassing.
And so you will literally just get out of bed. Do you have in your house now somewhere that you know that you will be able to go?
Yeah, from the age of 15, 16, I've always left paper out now. Whether I use paper or not is another thing. I still draw on near walls.
Do you? So, yeah. Dear, you in rented accommodation?
I was, and my past landlord, not too happy, but they're fine. But I've just moved into a new place, so I haven't said anything to the landlord yet. So touch wood.
Is there any way that you can control that? I mean, literally, if you just put paper down kind of next door to the bed and, you know, wherever you might be going to walk, does your subconscious self, unconscious self, whatever you call it, head for the paper?
I go for the paper, but I draw on the paper, plus I draw half on the floor. What's baffled a lot of people is I can start a drawing, leave it, and then go back to it a week later.
And also, you draw at incredible speed.
Yeah. I mean, on some of the footage I've got, I'm drawing some face and the speed of my hand is...
Looks like it's fast-forwarded.
Yeah, I can't even explain the speed of which I'm drawing, and I wish I could do it while I was awake.
But one of the happy side effects of this is that galleries have become quite interested in your work, haven't they?
Yeah, I've had a lot of interest here, Paris and New York. I don't know, people always ask, oh, are you going to sell any, and I've held off. I've got my own personal beliefs what some of the work represents, and I want to see what these people that are into physics are all about and everything before I start dishing the work out.
What do you think is in the pictures?
I think there's something deeper in sense of on a universe level. A lot of my drawings lately have been circles and different worlds, and these guys in New Zealand have picked up on one of my drawings that people into physics would only know about, so...
But isn't that going to really spook you out, Lee, if you find out that you're just some kind of a vehicle for somebody else's universe?
That'd be quite exciting.
You're a braver man than me.
No, it's exciting. I think there is a greater universe out there.
You're not going to turn out to be the human embodiment of a crop circle, are you?
Hopefully not. That would be interesting.
People must doubt you sometimes. They must think you're just winding everybody up.
Yeah, I've had a lot of, like, he's a hoax, he can draw whilst he's awake. And it's like I've always said, people can look at my school reports. To me, art, I think it's in you. And for me to go through high school not pursuing a gift which I have, I think would have been very foolish.
Does anything affect it? I mean, if you drink a lot, or, you know, if you eat chocolate or cheese or something like that?
Yeah, for the migraines, when I used to go to the doctor, they said cut out different foods, cheese, chocolate. That hasn't altered it at all. The only thing that does bring it on, though, a lot of the time is alcohol. So if I've had a late night or I've drank a lot, I tend to do a lot more drawings. So.
But you do the very intricate ones very well in that case. I mean, you'd certainly pass a walk the line test, wouldn't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Has your partner got used to your sleepwalking?
Yeah, it took him a while. At first he thought, yeah, it was a hoaxer. But, I mean, we've been together now 11 years, so it's taken him a few years. But, yeah, now he's used to it. He gets up, he's got the video camera next to the bed. People think, oh, yeah, it's great, but I've got a lot of video footage of migraines and that, and it's the following day that's the pain.
If you could lose the migraines, but it also meant losing the ability to do this, would you be happy to do that?
No, I still want to keep this in a way.
Really? Yeah. Do you want to see where it goes?
Yeah, if there's answers out there, I mean, there's obviously questions in my work, and if I can bring some answers, then yeah.
Lee Hadwin and his extraordinary story of his sleepwalking habits. Well, the author Lee Child is our guest this morning. Lee, do you have any link between art and the subconscious mind?
Yeah, I'm sure that there is a barrier between what you might call the back of your brain and the front of your brain. And I'm sure that if you're in an altered state for whatever reason, I mean, on the tape Lee mentioned if he's had a few drinks or if he is fast asleep, if somehow the back of the brain connects with the front of the brain, yeah, then you do see different dimensions and sort of deeper connections and more ability, frankly. It's happened to me once or twice where you're not thinking about the novel at all and you're thinking about something else. Maybe you are sleepy or maybe you are in some kind of other altered state and something just bubbles to the surface. And I'm sure that's a pretty standard experience for a lot of artists. What's dramatic here is the extent. You know, he can't draw at all while he's awake, and he's a fabulous drawer while he's asleep. It seems to be a very radical case.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it happens a lot.
Do we have the pictures up on our website? I'm just looking through the glass to the talented operatives next door. I think so, yes. There's a link. Promise, there's a link if people want to go and have a look at it. Right, some emails from last week. In amongst the hundreds of you who simply wanted to tell us where you were when you saw David Essex and how much that meant to you, this one stood out from the crowd. It's from Marion Dante.
As a nun, two of us queued in the early morning for cheap tickets, £2, so that we could see David in Godspell. We sat on the steps and had to move over to let the artists pass. Exciting and wearing full religious habits, but permitted to go because it was about Jesus.
Now, several of you wanted to point out that eating burnt toast is not very good for you. Carcinogens lurk there. But this one also came in from Nick Hughes.
Nick writes, "Dear Fee, when I was first married, my mother-in-law once burnt the toast. Being in early awe, I said, 'That's okay, I like burnt toast.' This was partly true, but it condemned me to a life of constant burnt toast. I did not make this mistake in my second marriage."
Well, good luck, Nick. And by the third, you may have cracked it all. This one came in from Valerie Shaw off the back of our interview with Stephen Wiles, who crossed the picket lines of the miners' strike in 1985.
"I was interested listening to Stephen Wiles about his strike breaking, but no one talks of the staff involved in these disputes. I worked at the NCB Computer Centre in Cannock, so lived through the strikes of 72 and 74. I crossed a picket line of about 200 miners every day. My husband wouldn't drop me at the gates in case they attacked his car, so I walked a narrow gap between them with my heart thumping, but with a smile and good morning to them. The day after the strike, there was a crowd of them again. My heart sank, but they shook my hand and thanked me for crossing their picket line. The reason? Because we did the miners' pensions at Cannock, and if we hadn't been there, then no pension. I worked long hours during the miners' strike to cover other staff. Best job I ever had, and I still miss it 35 years on."
More emails, they're always welcome to saturdaylive@bbc.co.uk. Now, there are many things that you can be present at the birth of, your children, your pets. This year's springtime is keeping us all waiting. But how many of us can say that we witnessed the birth of a whole nation? Well, Philip Dixon wrote to tell us about his I Was There moment, which involves the once-in-a-lifetime combination of some disco lights, Prince Charles, and the change from Rhodesia to Zimbabwe.
30 years ago, I was in my early 20s. I was living in Africa. I was working in finance by day and running a disco by night in the mining town of Kitwe, which is on Zambia's northern copper belt. Peace was finally breaking out in southern Africa, and an agreement had been reached at Lancaster House about the Rhodesia settlement. Our mutual borders were flung open. Travel was permitted to Rhodesia. I was very curious, of course. I wanted to see what would be the last vestiges of this stubborn and pariah state, who we'd been at war with, or rather, I should say, they'd been at war with us. My disco buddy and me, John, ran a disco called Spectrum. It was a music and light experience. The lights themselves badly needed replacing. They were a relic from the mid-70s. We had a bubble light that projected psychedelic patterns onto the wall. And this gear was really becoming quite passé, even for Africa. So John, my disco buddy, and me hatched a plan. We decided we wanted to go to Salisbury. We'd heard we could buy anything there. And the idea was to replace our ageing disco lights and bring them into the 1980s.
I and my colleagues came to serve here for the period necessary to bring about a ceasefire, to enable elections to be held, and to help bring your country to legal independence.
We heard the day after we made our bookings that the date for independence had been set, and it would coincide exactly with our travel plans. So suddenly our flights and our hotel reservations were like gold dust.
In a few days, Zimbabwe will become independent, and I shall hand over power to the government which the people of this country elected. My task will then be completed, and I shall return to London.
We realised we really wanted to be a part of it. It wasn't quite enough just to be there at the same time. So we hatched a plan.
This is where it's all happening tonight, Rufaro Stadium in the black African township of Harare, where in 2 hours' time, midnight in Rhodesia, this country gains its legal independence and becomes Zimbabwe. And already the stands are filling up.
We wanted to try and get into the stadium, and we had Zambian national registration cards with our photo on them. They looked very official, and we'd used this sort of ploy once before in Durban when we wanted to get into a very exclusive nightclub, and it had very mixed results. But that was our plan. It was very simple. It was a question of being bold and being brazen and being very polite and just trying to blag our way into Rufaro Stadium.
Tonight, most are looking forward rather than back.
So on the 17th of April, in the mayhem of 30,000 people, somehow we just got waved through. And in the confusion of it all, we found ourselves in the stadium behind the VIP box with the best view in town. Right in front of us sat Prince Charles, Lord Carrington. There was Lord Soames, who had been sort of sent into Rhodesia about a year before to be the last governor. There was the Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi and all the leaders of the frontline states, including our own president, Kenneth Kaunda of Zambia. Then as evening fell, Bob Marley, the reggae superstar, and the Wailers, his group, pounded onto the stage and he played Zimbabwe, which was his big anthem, a special song he'd written for the newly independent nation. And the crowd were just rapturous. I mean, this was their anthem. Eventually they became very restless and very eager for the hoisting of the new Zimbabwe flag. And the atmosphere seemed to change. It seemed to become very tense, very edgy. The security forces became very nervous and they fired tear gas into the crowd.
There was a moment of panic when tear gas drifted across the stands.
Shortly afterwards, the wind changed direction and there were wafts of this billowing towards the stage, the VIP box, and upwards towards John and me, and we were choking, our eyes were burning. This was an extremely unpleasant situation. And the VIPs and Bob Marley ran from the stage and they retreated and they had handkerchiefs over their eyes and noses. It was real mass panic. And it took about 45 minutes to quell the turmoil, to bring everything back under control.
Generals and former guerrilla leaders and prime ministers and prince went off to a banquet, while in the stadium the ordinary folk sang and danced away the hours to midnight.
On the stroke of midnight, a very solemn Prince Charles took the farewell salute from the Rhodesian Rifles.
The new flag went up to thunderous applause and the smoke from a 21-gun salute.
For the last time on the African continent, the British flag was lowered and the Zimbabwe flag was hoisted to a wild and static and jubilant crowd.
I, Robert Gabriel Mugabe, do swear that I will be faithful.
It was a very wild evening and it took a long time to exit the stadium. People were very jubilant. I mean, there was a lot of backslapping, and because Robert Mugabe had swept a victory on a Marxist ticket, we were all comrades. Everyone was a comrade. We were wearing paper hats with comrade on. The women were wearing chitenge, which is a vibrant African material, with comrade Mugabe emblazoned upon it. So there's a lot of colour. There was a lot of partying. And it went on into the early hours of the morning, if not later.
This is the voice of Zimbabwe.
It's heartbreaking. It really is. To see a once prosperous country with a lot of opportunity and a lot of optimism following the independence, to see it all implode like it has done. It was an extremely happy time. We had a realisation when we were there that we would never again see the birth of a nation. It won't happen in my lifetime. So it was a special moment then, and it's a special moment now.
It's another wonderful feature out of the Saturday Live box, and it was Philip Dixon's I Was There. Lee, your I Was There moment has a bit of a musical theme to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I can't compete with the formation of nations, but when I was 14, like every other male teenager in Britain, I was in a band, and we took it quite seriously and rehearsed. But because we were schoolboys, we finished at 11 at night, and the overnight rehearsal space was booked by the grown-ups aged 19 or so. And one night, this very pleasant, well-spoken local lad came in, about 19. We thought he was very grown up and sophisticated, to take a look at the facilities, because he had it booked for his new band overnight. And at 11 o'clock, we shoved our stuff to one side, and they all came in to install their stuff for the nighttime rehearsal. And this pleasant, well-spoken local boy was Robert Plant, and the new band was Led Zeppelin.
Oh, what happened to them?
Exactly, yeah.
You're now an exile from us, aren't you, Lee? Having grown up in Coventry and Sheffield, you list your homes now as an apartment in Manhattan and a house in the south of France, and also whichever airline is transporting you between those two places. Is that travel actually part of the appeal?
It is. I love travel, actually. I love to be on the way to somewhere else and with other people traveling for all different kinds of reasons. It's a mobile universe. And if you think about it, there are always millions of people in the world in transit at any particular time. And they've all got a story. They've all got stresses. They've all got hopes. And it's fascinating to watch them do it.
Mm. You are listening to Saturday Live this morning, a soft fondant centre and a dark chocolate shell. And yes, we know that Easter is about much more than confectionery. Carly Simon is one of the most talented singer-songwriters of her generation, so we had high hopes for her inheritance tracks, and she hasn't disappointed us. We're also just about to talk to a man who had a plan about going into space, and the author Lee Child is here. So is Sandy.
This morning we're off to islands which in their time have been called the Islands of Samson and the Ducks, Davis Land, Hawkins Maiden Land, and the Seabold Islands. Now you may understand the significance of all these name changes when I tell you that today the British call the place the Falklands, but trouble still stirs when others want to refer to them as Las Malvinas. There are just over 3,000 people living on the islands, along with 500,000 sheep. And to make sure everyone is represented, I'll be talking to an artist about the place and the people, and a vet about the sheep. Plus the extraordinary story of a Polish family who escaped Stalin and Hitler in the Second World War to come to Devon via India and Iran. Excess baggage, nothing if not varied, just after 10 with me, Sandy Toksvig.
Now, Lee, your hero, Jack Reacher, is a contented loner, isn't he? He's a man who owns no home, no knickknacks, no essential talisman, not even a radio, for goodness sake. Is that some kind of wish fulfilment for you? Are you doing an Ian Fleming in his creation of James Bond, living the life that you actually want to live?
I think it's wish fulfillment for a lot of people in that life is so complex and, we've all got mortgages and bills and responsibilities and commitments, and the idea that you can just walk away with that with nothing and you don't know where you'll be tomorrow, I think is quite enchanting. It's also, in a literary sense, a kind of metaphor for a much older-fashioned type of hero, because crime fiction these days has heroes that are usually damaged in some way. You know, they're alcoholics or recovering alcoholics or divorced recovering alcoholics or divorced recovering alcoholics with bullets lodged near their hearts. And it all gets just a little bit too miserable for me. I wanted to go way back to the kind of old-fashioned hero that didn't have problems. So Reacher's stripped-down lifestyle is partly wish fulfillment, I think, for the reader as much as for me, and partly to keep in tune with that metaphor. There's nothing about, it's not about yesterday, it's not about tomorrow, it's just about today and what he has to deal with.
So many people this morning have asked about the films. Overwhelmingly, our texts and emails are about that. And they have been, the books have been optioned, haven't they?
They all are optioned, yeah, and they have been for 13 years.
It's a slow process,
although, and it is very typical. I mean, what surprised me, I don't know if you remember the TV show ER, a very famous show, very, very successful. And it just finished, and in the obituaries to the show, it revealed that it was 20 years between its proposal and when it got on the air, which is an extraordinary long time with the kind of people that were involved. Michael Crichton as executive producer, big star. 20 years it took to get that show on the air. So 13 years for me is the blink of an eye, really. And I think something will happen. They've been developing it for a long time. They've got a lot of investment in it in terms of time and money. They've got a great script by a very well-known screenwriter. And my guess is something will happen maybe later this year or next year. I think it just has to. The head of steam is built up to the point where it must.
You've created this fantastic visual image of the person you'd like to play Jack Reacher, which is an actor who has William Hurt's head but Bruce Willis's pumped-up body. And yeah. I'm sure someone can make that for you somewhere, Lee.
Well, that's the alternative, I suppose, these days. It's just to do it all digitally. What I'd really like to do is get an acting coach for Lawrence Dallaglio, the England rugby player. I think he's my visual image of Jack Reacher, actually.
Yeah, I can see that working. This week sees the launch of the United Kingdom Space Agency. Based in Swindon, it's already been the butt of many jokes, which is cruel and unproductive. It is true, though, that we're 21st in the global space race, just behind Belgium, and our budgets aren't very big. But look, we're a nation of entrepreneurs and self-starters and tinkerers and dreamers, and if a father of three from West Yorkshire is anything to go by, then the space agency will be fine. Robert Harrison is an IT director from West Yorkshire, and a couple of years ago, he decided that he wanted to try taking some aerial shots of his house. His first plan never really got off the ground, so he hit upon the idea of using a balloon. And not only did this work, but it planted a seed in Robert's mind that took him all the way into near space. Well, he came in to see us at the docking station that is Saturday Live on Thursday, and he started by telling us about that first doomed project.
I got a remote control helicopter for my birthday, and I had a little play flying around the garden. I thought, be really nice to take some little aerial pictures of the house. So I had a go at trying to put a camera on the front of the helicopter and very quickly realised that there's no way that this helicopter could ever lift the weight of the camera. So then I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll get a helium balloon and I'll stick a camera on the bottom of the balloon and I'll launch that up on a piece of string and I'll take some nice aerial views of the house. I took that idea to bed with me and I slept on it overnight. I thought, well, if I cut that cord, I'll get some very interesting photographs, but I'd have a real problem trying to find the camera. So then I set about the next 3 or 4 days looking around on the internet and trying to find various ways of tracking the camera. And that's how it sort of started off, this process.
But how did it then transfer to being a process of using a weather balloon and actually going up into space?
Well, the weather balloon bit was quite easy because to actually lift a camera up, you need a fairly decent-sized balloon. Obviously, your common-day party balloon isn't the sort of balloon that's going to be able to lift a camera up. So I knew I needed a big balloon, and that led to the Met balloon. I obviously had to do quite a lot of programming and learning, I guess. I had to learn an awful lot of electronics and stuff like that. And then with the Civil Aviation Authority approval, I launched the camera on the balloon and I got the rather spectacular pictures back from that.
How much of all of this, Robert, did you know before you started? I mean, your day job isn't this kind of thing at all, is it?
No, my day job is working for a firm of patent agents in town. And basically, my job is the IT director. Nothing to do with... I knew a bit about programming, which was quite useful for this, but nothing about electronics. All that has been learnt over the last couple of years, surfing the web and speaking to a lot of very helpful and very knowledgeable people on the internet.
And did you always have a huge curiosity about space? I mean, is that what drove you as well?
Not a huge curiosity. I had a curiosity like most people have. I guess I still have my schoolboy curiosity for space.
Now, you've made it sound very simple, Robert, but I don't think it is that simple, is it? I don't think I'd be able to do it. You say that you built some kind of a tracking device. Now, talk me through that. Don't you have to apply for permission and sign some kind of thing and pay somebody else's satellite use and all that kind of thing?
The tracking device is actually quite simple. It consists of three components, really. A GPS device, which you can buy quite cheaply from an electronic shop for about £20. And it's very similar to the sat-nav that goes inside your car. And you take the information which the satellite gives you, which is obviously the latitude and longitude, which we're used to in our car, but it also gives you altitude. And then it transmits it via a little radio transmitter about the same power as your car key fob. And that information gets beamed back down to ground. Now, I can sit in my car on the ground, and using that information, I can work out where the camera is in sort of three-dimensional space. Every few minutes, it gives me a little update. So I can drive around in my car following this device as it floats through the atmosphere until it starts to make its descent.
So that is what prevented it from ending up, you know, somewhere, I don't know, in the middle of the Ethiopian desert. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, from launching to landing, it's about 3.5 hours. Some of the problems around this are the jet streams. The jet streams operate about 200 miles an hour on a very windy day, but they do have quiet days. And we look at the Met Office data quite regularly. It comes out every 6 hours, and they publish it all for free. And if the jet streams are quite quiet, then it's normally a key indicator for launch, as in it's not going to blow too far away. We don't want it to obviously land on anything exciting, like go towards London or something like that. So we aim to go into the Fenlands. And so far, so good. I've been in several fields and... two trees. The trees are a little bit more trickier to recover the camera from.
Right, that makes perfect sense. You've demystified a tiny part of this process for me, Robert. The other thing is, what does this contraption look like? I mean, how big is the whole thing?
The contraption consists of three parts. The balloon, a parachute for the return journey, and the payload, which is the payload is basically an insulated box in which it contains the camera and the tracking device. That is connected by a bit of string with a parachute already deployed, and that's connected to a meteorological balloon. That's filled up with helium, which is a gas which is lighter than air, and that's what is used to make the balloon ascend up into the stratosphere. As the balloon goes higher and higher, the air pressure gets less and less. And as the air pressure gets less, the balloon gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And rather like any balloon, if you blow it up too much, eventually it pops. And this is what happens. It gets to about 35 kilometres, about 21 miles into the Earth's atmosphere, 4 to 5 times the height of Everest. And at that point, the balloon pops and the parachute immediately deploys and the whole thing floats back down to Earth.
So talk me through that first initial flight, if that's what you call it, of the balloon. When you watched it go up, what did you really think it was going to manage to achieve?
Well, I thought I was going to get back some sort of aerial photography, something which you could take from an aeroplane. I thought it would go quite high. I remember going through those pictures. I sat down. Unfortunately, when the balloon landed, it landed in a field, and I couldn't look at the pictures straight away. Like, we went to the local pub, had a pint of beer because it had been a busy day, got the laptop out and put the data card in, and slowly went through each picture. And obviously, I got a few nice pictures around the house, aerial pictures. Then it went a bit higher into the cloud layer. Then it went above the cloud layer, and I could see some rivers, and I could start to see the coast of the UK. I thought, this is really fantastic. Then it started getting higher and higher and higher, and the sky started to go darker and darker and darker until it sort of turned black. I was thinking, well, that looks like space. And as it got even higher, you could start to work out the atmosphere layer of the Earth, and then you start to get the curvature of the Earth towards the top of the flight. And that was unbelievable and very unexpected. I was absolutely astounded by the pictures that came back.
They are even, truly beautiful. Sorry. Were you in the pub by yourself? Did you have anybody else to show them to? Or was it just you in the corner going, ooh, ah, ooh?
No. To be fair, my mother had come out with me to help do the driving while I was messing around. Driving and operating all this stuff at the same time, particularly on the first to go, would probably be illegal, I should think.
Yes. Yeah. So mum was doing the ewing and the ahhing as well.
Yeah, so she was absolutely as shocked as I was, really. She was not expecting to see pictures of space, basically. It's what they look like. It's not technically space, but we have a bit of an artistic licence. We call it near space.
When you first saw those pictures, Robert, what did you feel? I mean, were you quite overwhelmed?
It took a few moments for it to all sort of sink in and realise that you're actually looking at your planet. But I'm not a particularly religious person, but there's something quite overwhelming looking at your own planet. And I mean, to actually have taken the pictures myself, everyone quite likes the pictures of the Earth. I don't think anyone's ever seen a picture of the Earth and gone, oh, I don't like looking at that.
There's something about really dull,
it that it is quite overwhelming, and thinking this is the only place we know where people live.
What kind of a camera are you using to take these photographs?
It's a very standard point-and-click camera. I purchased it off eBay, £50, and it just sits inside this insulated box. It's in an insulated box as well because the temperatures are quite cold at those altitudes. It gets down to about minus 60 degrees, so it needs to be kept warm. What we do with the camera is we actually put some software on it from the internet, and that allows you to reprogram the camera to make it take pictures in certain timed intervals. For this process, I set it up so every 5 minutes it shoots 2 minutes of video and takes 8 pictures and then goes to sleep for another 3 minutes. It just does that process throughout the whole duration of the flight. This really is sort of trial by error, I guess. I was very fortunate on this first flight. I got some fantastic pictures back.
How much does this whole thing cost?
£500 all in. You can do this. It sounds very cheap. But what really is involved is the R&D time, the research and development and the learning. And there must be probably about 9 months of fairly hard work burning the candle at both ends to do this.
But it is true that you're doing what NASA would do for about 100 times the cost?
Yeah, I mean, I get pictures that look like the ones that NASA send back. That's true.
Is it true, though, that someone from NASA did phone you up and say, how come you can do this for £500? Tell us how to do it.
What actually happened was that someone was actually interested in how we took the photographs, and once they realised there was no rocketry involved, they said, well, very nice pictures, and obviously that's how you've managed to get to those altitudes.
How many other balloons have you launched? I mean, is this an ongoing thing? Is it something you do every weekend?
It is an ongoing hobby. There's quite a few of us in the UK. Well, I say a few, there's about 4 different groups within the UK doing this sort of stuff. Personally, I've actually launched about 8 or 9 flights to date. You must get Civil Aviation Authority approval, and before launch you have to contact the local air traffic control, who will then basically clear the local airspace and then give you permission to actually launch.
Yes, because it would be very dangerous if we all went out this weekend and tried to launch weather balloons up wherever
Absolutely.
We fancied. Were there any pictures of those dreadful helium balloons from children's parties floating past as your weather balloon went up with the camera?
No, I didn't see any of those dreadful helium balloons, I'm pleased to say. They actually don't go very high because they're already quite well inflated when you let go of them. And once they get up to about 1 or 2 kilometres above the Earth's atmosphere, they tend to burst and then fall back down to Earth. So the trick is, if you ever have to fill in one of those addresses and stick it on a helium balloon, it's the one that gets the furthest of the way that wins, make sure you get a balloon that isn't very filled up.
Right, that's cheating, Robert, for goodness sake. When you took your photographs into work to show your colleagues, you know, sometimes people do that here. It can be a little bit dull having to look through somebody else's pictures. What was their reaction? Were they very supportive of what you were up to at the weekends?
Well, I should go back just before that, because I did mention to some people about sort of 6 months before that. I said, oh, I'm thinking about sending a camera up into sort of the atmosphere. Might get some great pictures of the Earth and stuff like that. And they all looked at me as though I was slightly mad. So I didn't really say anything more about it until I got the results. And then I posted a few pictures around. I said, remember that time we sat in the pub and I said I was going to send a camera up? Well, here are the results. And, yes, I think I didn't hear any on taking the mickey this time.
And will you ever give up the day job, or is this always going to be just a lovely hobby?
I don't think anyone's going to be coming calling soon asking for my services. No, it's a great hobby, it's great pictures, and quite frankly, I really am standing on the shoulders of giants. And people have been doing this for a very, very long time. And I've been very lucky with having some exceptional pictures and having quite a lot of attention with this. But it's been a very unusual experience, this whole process, actually.
Robert Harrison, and you can see some of the pictures on our website and a link to Robert's website where you can see all of them. They're worth taking a look at. Now, one of the things that Robert wants to do, Lee, with the photos is inspire school children and, you know, really help bring about the next generation of scientists. You're trying to do something similar, aren't you, just in the field of academic enhancement. Where are you doing that?
I'm doing it at my old university at Sheffield. I'm paying the tuition for 52 students who otherwise would have had to drop out because they haven't got any money. And I love Sheffield for that reason, because it's a very practical, pragmatic town where they actually do useful things there. And I tried to choose the students. The scholarships are called Jack Reacher Scholarships. And as you know, Reacher is a particular type of person. So I tried to choose students who he would approve of. The kind of kids that will get things done. And without being cute about it, I mean, the story about the space photographs is exactly what Britain is great at. NASA is very inside the box type of an organization. You remember that story about they spent $1 million developing a pen, a ballpoint pen that would write in space without leaking or exploding. The Russians used a pencil. It's that kind of the pragmatism that we need. And I'm hoping that Sheffield University is the kind of place where you can be seriously academic but also seriously sensible. Maybe it's not a coincidence that guy came from West Yorkshire. Sheffield's in South Yorkshire. Yorkshire's maybe a very practical county.
I love everything about Robert Harrison's story as well. And imagine if you went into school and the teacher said, what's your show and tell? And you said, well, I made a space probe. Here are my pictures. Here is Elvis again with his final poem.
This is Flight of Fancy. Tethered to Earth by gravity's guy ropes, trudging out from primordial sludge, sleepwalking down the years in deep-sea divers' boots, nose to the grindstone we endlessly drudge. Oh, would that we could fly like Icarus, but without his wings of wax, to ascend unto the heavens like a beautiful balloon, up, up and away above the cloud-capped steeples, oh, to soar above the sun and put a girdle round the moon, to hover over stars as bees to flowers in a garden, to clutch the floating firmament in outstretched hand, to drift like thistledown across the boundless universe, to see the world as a tiny grain of sand, to behold the bigger picture, to watch our planet fade from view, to wonder why we keep its petty pace, a bright blue spinning dot in a kaleidoscope, lost in time and space, to feel how flimsy is the fabric of man's pageant, how slight every worry, every grievance, every care, to sense that Wayne's sprained ankle pain will not be front-page news on Mars, to hear each passing frenzy's empty echo in the air, then to gently drop deflated from such dizzy, giddy heights, back with a bump to our daily earthbound strife, to know we can but only laugh at this glorious cosmic joke and breathe in deep the fleeting moment we call life.
Thank you very much. Carly Simon was born in New York in 1945. Her mother was a civil rights activist and her father a publisher, but both had musical bones. He played the piano and she liked to sing, and Carly wasn't the only child to inherit their combined talents. Her career began when she formed the Simon Sisters with her sister Lucy. They had a minor hit with a song called Winking, Blinking and Nod, but I think it's the later solo ones we remember more. You're So Vain, The Right Thing to Do, Nobody Does It Better, and Let the River Run, the theme she penned for the film Working Girl, earned her an Oscar, a Golden Globe and a Grammy. So many things are known about Carly Simon, her liaisons with Warren Beatty and Mick Jagger, her marriage to James Taylor, with whom she has two grown-up children, and her wide, wide smile. But until now, nobody has known her inheritance tracks.
The song that I inherited was a song called Something Wonderful, which was written by Oscar Hammerstein and Richard Rodgers, and was from The King and I, both the play and then again the movie.
He may not always say what you would have him say.
I think it dwells and it makes poetic the compassion and the empathy that one human being has for another. And in this case, particularly a woman toward a man. And we all know that men have enormous egos. And this makes a sweetness toward the ego that is usually not.
Then all at once he'll do something wonderful.
My childhood was one of tremendous confusion for me. I was the youngest of three girls, but I had a father who was always doting on them, and I was the child that came out looking the way he didn't want his child to look. And I felt not an iciness, but a disinterest coming from him.
You'll always go along, defend him when he's wrong.
I think it set the stage for a whole lot of my adult neuroses. However, I had two uncles who made the whole thing a whole lot better by being tremendously fun, and they just thought I was the cat's meow, and they taught me music and they taught me baseball.
You'll get your love.
Well, he didn't want monkeys in his family. He thought I looked like a monkey. I am part black and I'm part Jewish from his family, but he didn't like to own that for his own neuroses. And those were two minorities that he didn't put on pedestals. I don't think he quite understood this about himself. And so I certainly don't blame him in that I don't think it was his fault that he felt that way.
And tell him when he's strong, he is wonderful.
I remember one thing he wrote to me was, "Roses are red, violets are pink. I love you with your darling fat nose. I've just had a drink." That made me feel so terrible about myself. And I'm sure he didn't know that it made me feel terrible.
A man who needs your love can be wonderful.
Very, very touching to me. I chose a song by Cat Stevens called How Can I Tell You? And I think it's a song that I did pass down to my children, and both of them sing it. Ben sang it at Sally's wedding. It's a song that's made so tender by its simplicity. I love the melody to it. The words are just simple and yet unique.
How can I tell you that I love you? I love you. But I can't think of right words to say. I long to tell you that I'm always thinking of you.
I haven't performed it in any shows. I performed it a lot at parties or for friends or especially for my children when I first sang it for them. And very soon they will be passing it down to their children, and I know that that's going to happen. My daughter just had a baby, and I know that she sings that song to him as a lullaby. Being a grandmother is quite delicious, although I didn't really get to know him until he was two. So being that he's a two-year-old, he couldn't be less interested in me. I keep on telling him how interesting I am. I'm always walking with you, but I look and you're not there. Sally is the eldest and Ben is the youngest. I am, of course, equally proud of them, equally in love with them. I think that the terminology in love is actually apt. I have that feeling when either of them walk into a room or when I used to pick them up at school and they would be walking toward me, I would have an adrenaline rush. And it was just as exciting as any time I've ever been in love with a man in a romantic way. I think the love of simplicity and the fact that you can write a song and you can put all sorts of pyrotechnical and complicated singing techniques and melismatics, but sometimes the most effective and the most complete songs are the ones that just say it so simply. I need to know you, need to feel my arms around you, feel my arms around you like sea around the shore. We were always, as they were growing up, we were CBS, Carly, Ben, and Sally. And there's a certain way that we sing that song as a threesome. It's so very, very much like one voice. And it's so moving because it's the three of us without James. The two offspring of the mother and the father, and the mother and the children are left singing that song about the father. So it takes on a whole different meaning. And I'm hoping that the father did get to hear it. How can I tell you that I love you? I love you, but I can't.
Are you sure she's finished talking? Because I came in a little bit too soon, didn't I, on the Philip Dixon piece, and I didn't let him tell you that he never got the disco lights. And people all over the country, they just couldn't concentrate until they found out that fact. Lee, I could happily spend another hour in your company, but we've got to go. A final lovely text comes from Kate saying, what did you treat yourself to when you got your eight-figure advance?
I bought my wife a painting by Renoir. She loves Impressionist art, and she deserved it.
I love that answer because I thought you were going to say a box of chocolates. Our Easter thanks go to Carly Simon, to Robert Harrison, to Elvis McGonagall, to Lee Hadwin and to Philip Dixon. Lee Child's latest book, 61 Hours, is out now. It comes highly recommended. Have a super Easter. Don't eat them all at once.